Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Gopi Jana Balabha Giri Varadhari.
Gopi Jana Balabha Giri Varadhari.
Surandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Banachari.
Yamuna Tira Banachari.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Gopi Jana Balabha Girivardhari. Jaya Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana.
Jaya
Yamuna Tira Banachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama,
Hare Rama, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama,
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
This is Canto 4, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 12. Dhruva Maharaj goes back to Godhead. Text 5. Tadgachadruva Padram De
Tadgachadruva Padram De
Bhagavanta Marokshajam
Bhagavantam Marokshajam
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham
Tadgachadhruvam Bhadram Te
Tadgachadhruvam Bhadram Te
Bhagavantam Adhokshajam
Bhagavantam Adhokshajam
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham
Tadgachadhruvam Bhadram Te
Tadgachadhruvam Bhadram Te
Bhagavantam Adhokshajam
Bhagavantam Adhokshajam
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham
Please.
Tadgachadhruvam Bhadram Te
Bhagavantam Adhokshajam
Sarvabhutatma Bhavena
Sarvabhutatma Vigraham Word for word equivalents.
Tat
Therefore,
gacha, gacha,
come,
dhruva,
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 bhadram,
bhadram,
good
fortune,
te,
te,
unto you,
bhagavantam,
bhagavantam,
unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
Adhokshajam,
Adhokshajam,
who is beyond the concepts of material senses,
who is beyond the concepts of material senses,
Sarvabhuta,
Sarvabhuta,
all living entities,
all living entities.
Atma-bhavena,
Atma-bhavena,
by thinking of them as one,
by thinking of them as one.
Sarvabhuta,
Sarvabhuta,
in all living entities.
In all living entities.
Atma,
Atma,
super soul.
Super soul.
Vigraham,
Vigraham,
having form.
Having form.
Translation: My dear Dhruva, come forward. May the Lord always grace you with good fortune, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is beyond our sensory perception, is the supersoul of all living entities. Thus, all entities are one without distinction. Begin, therefore, to render service unto the transcendental form of the Lord, who is the ultimate shelter of all living entities. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Here the word vigraham, having specific form, is very significant, for it indicates that the absolute truth is ultimately the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is explained in Brahma Samhita, Satchidananda Vigraha. He has form, but his form is different from any kind of material form. The living entities are the marginal energy of the Supreme Form. As such, they are not different from the Supreme Form. Dhruva Maharaj is advised herewith to render service unto the Supreme Form. That will include service to other individual forms. For example, a tree has a form, and when the water is poured on the root of the tree, the other forms, the leaves, twigs, flowers, and fruits, are automatically watered. The Mayavada conception that because the absolute truth is everything, he must be formless, is rejected here. Rather, it is confirmed that the absolute truth has form, and yet he is all-pervading. Nothing is independent of him. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Shakshurun Minitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutade Svayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Shvapadam Ikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvetam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakanvitam Shcha. He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamam Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarugyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Tadgachha Dhruvam Bhadram Te Bhagavantam Adhokshajam Sarva Bhutatma Bhavena Sarva Bhutatma Vigraham. Having heard from Svayambhuva Manu in the last chapter, who advised Dhruva not to kill the Yakshas, Dhruva is now agreed and he's going to cease his fighting. Having made that nice decision, then the maintainer of the Yakshas, Kuvera, who also happens to be the treasurer of the demigods, has personally come to thank Dhruva for his wise decision and speak a little transcendental philosophy to Dhruva also. It's natural that a devotee likes to hear the philosophy of transcendence, even if he already knows it. Sometimes if you tell somebody something that they already know, they'll say, hey, you're preaching to the choir, which seems to indicate they don't really want to hear any more of it. But the word Bhadram Te here is saying he's giving his blessings because he knows that Dhruva wants to hear about Krishna. Krishna's philosophy, Krishna's pastimes are all happy. The devotee is happy to hear all of these pastimes. Bhagavad Gita says in chapter 10, text 9, Machita Matgata Prana Bodhayanta Parasparam. What's the third line? Thank you. That katayantashchamam. Those talks about Krishna, how does that affect a devotee? Tushyanticha ramanticha. They enjoy it very much. So Dhruva is happy to hear from Kubera about Krishna's philosophy, which is another type of Krishna katha. There's talks by Krishna, like Bhagavad Gita, that's Krishna Katha. And then there's talks about Krishna, like Srimad Bhagavatam, also Krishna Katha. Now, in this verse, the aspect of the philosophy regarding the impersonal effulgence of Krishna is mentioned. He's talking about how all living entities are one without distinction, and that therefore we should render service to the transcendental form of the Lord, who is the ultimate shelter of all living entities. In one sense, the reason he's speaking about this is also to remind Dhruva that this is why you're not going to kill the Yakshas, because actually you're one with them, in the sense that they're also children of God, you're also a child of God. You're all in the shelter of the Lord. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Also, chapter 14, text 27. Krishna speaks about the fact that a merely impersonal understanding of Krishna as the absolute truth, with no realization of his personal feature, is an incomplete understanding. He says, Pramano hi pratishtaham amritas yavyayashyacha shashvatasya chadharmasya sukhanaisyai kandikasyacha. And I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable, and eternal, and is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. Whenever we hear references in the Vedic literature to the impersonal absolute truth, we should understand that this is something coming from Krishna. It's in and of itself, it's nothing more than an energy of the energetic source, which is Krishna, like everything else. Just as it is a delusion to think ourselves independent of Krishna, it's also a delusion to think the impersonal oneness to be independent of Krishna. This is where our senses fail us. Our senses condition us to think that things are discrete units, independent of anything else. Looks like a chair is a chair, and it's there, but it's not there. Okay. But on the molecular level, those distinctions start to blur as molecules are constantly in flux from one object to another. Disintegration is constantly taking place, so the impermanence is revealed. And then on a deeper subatomic level, it's a field of energy. And that's all pervasive. So we can't really make these distinctions on every level of reality. And that's where the senses limit us. When we try to bring our senses, when we try to bring our understanding to the absolute truth, therefore we have to go beyond our sense perception to access that information, that knowledge, that truth. Therefore, the Lord is described in this verse with the name Adhokshajam. Adhokshajam means that he's beyond our limited sense perception. Just as Krishna is the basis of everything, like he says in uh, 10:8, Aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam pura bhava samvita. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who know this worship me with all their heart. Just as he's the source of everything that we see, he's also the source of the impersonal Brahman, which can't even really be called a thing, per se, because it's without qualities. As soon as you begin to describe it, you've missed it. The Buddhists and certain Mayavadis have a Sanskrit phrase which they use to describe this fact that you can't describe the oneness, the all-pervasive feature of absolute truth. They say nirvachaniya, which means you can't talk about it, which has a couple of meanings you could apply to it. One is the meaning they intend, which is it's beyond the scope of words. We say ineffable in English. But another meaning is somewhat ironic, and it reveals, if you interpret it this way, that they're having some blind faith in their doctrine, and they won't really give it a fair critique. When they say nirvachaniya, they say you can't talk about it, you can imagine them plugging their ears and say, don't talk about that. That's also another way of looking at nirvachaniya. Krishna gives complete information about his relationship to the absolute, to the all-pervasive oneness in Bhagavad Gita. Another verse is there in chapter 9, text 4, where he's describing his relationship to the absolute truth, the all-pervasiveness, which is another feature of absolute truth. By me, in what is the Sanskrit? Maya tatam idam sarvam jagadavyakta murtina matsthani sarvabhutani nachaham teshva bhashpita. This avyakta murti, the unmanifested form of the Lord, is being described. By me in my unmanifested form, the entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. So the previous verse, Brahmanohi Pratishtaham, it was a little general. It was talking about how the Brahma is supported by Krishna. This is somewhat abstract language, but now here it's becoming a little more general. He's speaking about how that all-pervasiveness is localized in this universe. Yes, it's all-pervasive. The entire universe is pervaded, but it's more general because it's referring to a specific universe. In Vedic ontology and cosmology involves many universes. So the whole universe is pervaded, and so this gives us a little tighter focus to understand that this world that I'm seeing with my very eyes is pervaded by that Brahman, which was previously described somewhat abstractly. So it's this stuff I'm faced with, and that actually my body is composed of, is all pervaded by Brahma. And Krishna is saying that maya, by me, in my avyakta murti, my unmanifested form. So when we understand that all-pervasive oneness, we can also take from Shastra something deeper than our senses can let us perceive, and that's that Krishna is personally present in that all-pervasive oneness. Simply by sense perception, most people can come to a realization that there's an impersonal oneness to everything, an all-pervasive absolute truth that binds us together, an interconnectedness to things, a great spirit. You'll find it in every culture. In China, at one point it was called Tao. In Native American cultures, it may be called Great Spirit. I don't know what their languages were like, so I can't use their word. And there may even be... Anyway, there's other names also. But this is available simply by two types of evidence. There are different pramanas by which in the Sanskrit language are named to give us evidence of something's existence. The pramana of pratyaksha is our sense perception. Then there's pramana called anuman, which is logical induction based on our sense perceptions. And then finally there's shruti, which is hearing from someone who knows. So simply by pratyaksha and anuman, we're able to infer that there is an all-pervasive oneness. We don't need Shastra to tell us that. That's why there's so many kind of like New Age hippie type people who have realization that there's some absolute oneness. Now, the problem is that without Shabda, without Shastra, someone who knows, telling us more details about Krishna, then Adhokshaja, it's inaccessible. You can't go beyond your little inductive power, which lets you know that there's something great. But it's fuzzy. It's fuzzy without the clarity offered by Krishna. Now, turning to Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna gives some basic information about the Absolute Truth and its behavior, its relationship to the world. And Srimad Bhagavatam then goes on to explicate the details of the Absolute Truth conclusively. And that's there in the first canto, it's at the bookmark, first canto, Chapter 2, Text 11, which says, Vidanti tattva viras tattvam yajnanam advayam brahmeti paramatveti bhagavan iti shabhyate. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. So we talked about Brahma, the all-pervasive oneness. two more names are given here, Paramatma and Bhagavan. Generally, because we're raised in a Christian background, we have some idea of an absolute person, God, personal God, and some kind of, and because of the just natural understanding given to us by our senses and our logic, we can understand, infer that there's some all-pervasive oneness. And depending on our culturation, we may also have some realization that there's someone in the heart there who's giving us guidance. But Bhagavatam doesn't want to leave any of that up to chance. And so it gives us absolutely clear information that the absolute truth is in fact personal, localized yet all-pervasive, and completely non-distinct, all-pervasive. The Brahma Samhita Prabhupada quoted in today's purport, I can take that if you like, the Prabhupada quoted in today's purport from Brahma Samhita, he said, Ishwara, he said, Satchidananda Vigraha. So there's three features of the Absolute Truth being described here, Sat, Chid, and Ananda. So these correlate to Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan also. Brahman is Sat, it's eternal. Paramatma is Sat and Chit, it's eternal, and it's also full of knowledge. It gives us that understanding by which we can guide, we can be guided in life. And Bhagavan is Sat, Chit, and Ananda, he's full of bliss. Loving relationships, rasa. And that rasa is really what's moving everything. So Bhagavatam is giving us access to that thing which will capture our heart and remedy our miseries, which is what, you know, everybody is suffering for lack of Krishna consciousness, lack of this rasa, loving relationship with the Absolute Truth. Even though there's some vague idea that God is a person in many spiritual traditions, including the Christian tradition we grew up with, most of the time, if you speak to someone deeply about the subject, they backpedal on that issue and turn God again into an impersonal void of some sort. If you try to ascribe detailed personality issues, they'll say, oh, this is, you can't talk about that. You're vachaniya, but they don't say the Sanskrit word, but that's what they mean. We can't talk about that. We don't know. Prabhupada often said, God is great, but how great is God? That we're not sure about. They can speculate, oh, he's this great, but where's the Shastra that's backing it up? That's available in Vedic literature. And actually it's available in their literature also, but most people don't know how to see it because there's lack of bhakti. Their bhakti gets mixed up with karma and with jnana, with desires for fruitive activities, praying to God for stuff. Give me this, give me that. Give me, give me, give me. That's actually love of stuff rather than love of God. And it's using God as an instrument to provide stuff. Prabhupada sometimes says, Krishna is not my order carrier. Like when we go to the restaurant, the waiter comes by, what would you like? That's not the conception of God, that give me this and this. It's as that said, then because of that kind of mixed up conceptions of bhakti and karma is the desire for stuff there, mixing up your bhakti and your karma, then there's some contamination in the heart. We can't see Krishna without prema. Premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena santav sadaiva hridayeshu vilokayanti. The Lord is visible within the heart through prema, having your eyes smeared with the ointment of love of God. And similarly, there's the knowledge aspect. If we think that to know God is the most important thing, then those who are incapable of knowledge are incapable of the most important thing. And so that's also a misunderstanding. Knowledge is good, but it should be subordinate to love. Everyone can love. No one is incapable of love, although some are incapable of knowledge, some are incapable of action. Karma and jnana are secondary. Important, but secondary. Bhakti is important, most important, essential. What motivates a lot of people to adopt impersonalist philosophy is frustration with this material world. They've been burned by bad relationships, they've lost their investments, they've made bad choices, and they're suffering. And so some of them become intelligent enough to realize that, hey, everything that's ever made me suffer has a form. My girlfriend, my job, my boyfriend, my lack of a job, my unemployment line, my hungry stomach, my insane mind, all this stuff is limited. It's all nameable and has a definite beginning and end. So that's the problem. The problem is all this stuff. I want to be free from stuff. And if they have a little more philosophical integrity, they'll start to look at their body and say, you know, this body is also stuff. So I really just wish that it was all pervasive. Everything could just be one, and I could stop suffering because there's no more me. There's no more distinction between friend and enemy, rich and poor, hungry and fiddled. All these temporary things are dissolved in that field of freedom. So they'll speak. They'll have that understanding. It's born of frustration. But the Shastra gives us something deeper, a deeper level of that. That is a true realization, but it's incomplete. This is the essence of what I'm speaking about today, that the impersonal Brahman conception is real but incomplete. So we get the absolute perspective from Shastra. A good example is in Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhyalila, chapter 6, texts 263 through 268. I'll just read the translations. Well, I like the Bengali also. It's very sweet sounding language. I'll give it a try. Bhattacharya kahe bhakti sama nahi mukti phala bhagavad bhakti vimukher hoya danda kevala. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya replied, "The awakening of pure love of Godhead, which is the result of devotional service, far surpasses liberation from material bondage. For those averse to devotional service, merging into the Brahman effulgence is a kind of punishment." And in Prabhupada's purport, there's a mention of a verse from Brahmanda Purana, which explains that both demons who were killed by Krishna and impersonalists go into the impersonal Brahman So that's one way of understanding why it's punishment, because you're residing in the same place as those demons. Then the Bhattacharya continued to speak in text 2:64 and 5. Krishna vigraha ye satya nahi mane ye ninda yudhai dika kare tan rasane seidurya danda hoy brahma sayujya mukti tara mukti palanahe ye kare bhakti. The impersonalists who do not accept the transcendental form of Lord Sri Krishna and the demons who are always engaged in blaspheming and fighting with him are punished by being merged into the Brahman effulgence. But that does not happen to the person engaged in devotional service of the Lord. 66. It's going to give us different kinds of liberation. Yadyapi se mukti hoy pancha parakar salokya samipya sarupya sarshti sayujar. There are five kinds of liberations. Salokya, samipya, sarupya, sarshti, and sayujya. I'll read Prabhupada's purport because it gives us the definition of these. Salokya means that after material liberation, one is promoted to the planet where the Supreme Personality of Godhead resides. Samipya means remaining an associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sarupya means attaining a four-handed form exactly like that of the Lord. Sarshti means attaining opulences like those of the Supreme Lord. And Sayujya means merging into the Brahman effulgence of the Lord. These are the five types of liberation. Salokyari chari yari haya seva dvar tabu kadachit bhakta kare angikar. If there is a chance to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a pure devotee sometimes accepts salokya, sarupya, samipya, or sarshti forms of liberation, but never sayujya. And finally, text 68. Sayujya shunite bhaktira haya grina bhaya naraka vanchaye tabu sayujya nalaya. A pure devotee does not even like to hear about sayujya mukti, which inspires him with fear and hatred. Indeed, the pure devotee would rather go to hell than merge into the effulgence of the Lord. But the devotee is interested in devotional service to Krishna. But in the Brahman effulgence, there's no scope for that devotional service because there's no you. That's the problem. And in fact, even though a devotee may sometimes accept the others, if there's scope for service of the Lord, the other four types of liberation, he doesn't aspire for that because he's only interested in serving the Lord. As our Hridayananda Maharaj says, why sweat the geography? It doesn't matter where you serve, even in hell. And Brahma Samhita gives a nice quote about this Brahman effulgence also, the absolute relationship of Krishna to it. Yasya prabha prabhavato jangaranda koti kotish vashesha vasudari vibhuti bhinna tad brahma nishkalamanantam ashesha bhutam govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose effulgence is the source of the non-differentiated Brahman mentioned in the Upanishads, being differentiated from the infinity of glories of the mundane universe. He appears as the indivisible, infinite, limitless truth. Okay. And in the last sentence of this purport, this is where I came across this word residual and had to look it up to find out why it was used this way. And then I found out about the cool etymology of it. The non-differentiated Brahman is indivisible, hence is also one without a second, and is the infinite and residual entity. So he's infinite, he's everywhere, and residual, he's residing back there in Vrindavan. Even though he's everywhere, he's also residing back in Vrindavan. It's like a very precise and beautiful way of using the word. Yes. Residual entity.
Yeah.
Okay, and the last reference for you today is here in Antya Lila chapter 3,
where this paper is?
Yeah, the big paper. Yeah, text 172 through 214. We're just going to hear a little pastime, which describes a conflict, what happened one time when a devotee had a disagreement with an impersonalist about this issue of the truth of the all-pervasive oneness. Ekadina Balaram Minati Kariya Majumdarera Shabhaya Aila Thakure Lanya. One day Balaramacharya requested Haridas Thakur with great humility to come to the assembly of the Majumdars, Hiranya, and Govardhan. Thus Balaramacharya went there with Haridas Thakur. We'll just read all the verses. Seeing Haridas Thakur, the two brothers immediately stood up and fell at his lotus feet. Then with great respect they offered him a place to sit. In that assembly there were many learned scholars, brahmanas, and respectable gentlemen. The two brothers Hiranya and Govardhan were also greatly learned. Everyone there began to speak of Haridas Thakur's great qualities as if they had five mouths. Hearing this, both brothers were extremely happy. It was mentioned in that assembly that Haridas Thakur chanted the holy names of Krishna 300,000 times a day. Thus all the learned scholars began to discuss the glories of the holy name. Some of them said, "By chanting the holy name of the Lord, one is freed from all reactions of sinful life." Others said, "Simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord, a living being is liberated from material bondage." Haridas Thakur protested, "These two benedictions are not the true result of chanting the holy name. Actually, by chanting the holy name without offenses, one awakens his ecstatic love for the lotus feet of Krishna. When a person is actually advanced and takes pleasure in chanting the holy name of the Lord, who is very dear to him, he's agitated and loudly chants the holy name. He also cries, laughs, and becomes agitated and chants just like a madman, not caring for outsiders. Liberation and extinction of the reactions of sinful life are two concomitant byproducts of chanting the holy name of the Lord. An example is found in the gleams of the morning sunlight. As the rising sun immediately dissipates all the world's darkness, which is deep like an ocean, so the holy name of the Lord, if chanted once without offenses, dissipates all the reactions of a living being's sinful life. All glories to that holy name of the Lord, which is auspicious for the entire world." After reciting this verse, Haridas Thakur said, "O learned scholars, please explain the meaning of this verse." But the audience requested Haridas Thakur, "It is better for you to explain the meaning of this important verse." Haridas Thakur said, "As the sun began to rise, even before it's visible, it dissipates the darkness of night. With the first glimpse of sunlight, fear of thieves, ghosts, and demons immediately disappears, and when the sun is actually visible, everything is manifest, and everyone begins performing his religious activities and regulative duties. Similarly, the first hint of that offenseless chanting of the Lord's holy name has awakened dissipates the reaction of sinful life immediately." Okay, this verse uses the word namabhas there. That's namabhas, the reflection of the holy name. "And when one chants the holy name offenselessly, one awakens to service and ecstatic love at the lotus feet of Krishna." So the difference between namabhas and shudhanam here is that namabhas means you're trying sincerely to avoid the offenses, and shudhanam means you have completely successfully avoided all of the offenses. So simply by trying, what's the result? Liberation is the insignificant result derived from a glimpse of the awakening of offenseless chanting, the namabhas of the holy name. Just by trying, you're liberated. While dying, Ajamil chanted the holy name of the Lord, intending to call his son Narayan. Nevertheless, he attained the spiritual world. What then to speak of those who chant the holy name with faith and reverence? Liberation, which is unacceptable to a pure devotee, is always offered by Krishna without difficulty. My devotees do not accept Salokya, Sarshti, Sarupya, Samipya, or oneness with me, even if I offer these liberations in preference of serving me. At the house of Hiranya and Govardhan Majumdar, a person named Gopal Chakravarti was officially the chief tax collector. This Gopal Chakravarti lived in Bengal. His duty as chief tax collector was to collect 1,200,000 coins to deposit in the treasury of the emperor. He had handsome bodily features, and he was learned and youthful, but he could not tolerate the statement that simply by glimpsing the awakening of the Lord's holy name one can attain liberation. This young man, Gopal Chakravarti, became very angry upon hearing the statements of Haridas Thakur. He immediately criticized him. "Oh, assembly of learned scholars," he said, "just hear the conclusion of the emotional devotee. After many millions upon millions of births, when one is complete in absolute knowledge, one still may not achieve liberation. Yet this man says that one may attain it simply by awakening of a glimpse of the holy name." Haridas Thakur said, "Why are you doubtful? The revealed scriptures say that one can attain liberation simply by a glimpse of offenseless chanting of the holy name. For a devotee who enjoys the transcendental bliss of devotional service, liberation is most insignificant. Therefore, pure devotees never desire to achieve liberation. My dear Lord, O Master of the Universe, since I have directly seen you, my transcendental bliss has taken the shape of a great ocean. Being situated in that ocean, I now realize all other so-called happiness, including even Brahmananda, to be like the water contained in the hoofprint of a calf." Gopal Chakravarti said, "If one is not liberated by Namabhas, then you may be certain that I shall cut off your nose." Then Haridas Thakur accepted the challenge offered by Gopal Chakravarti. "If by Namabhas liberation is not available," he said, "certainly I shall cut off my nose." All the members of the assembly who had heard the challenge were greatly agitated, and they got up, making a tumultuous sound. Hiranya and Govardhan Majumdar both immediately chastised the Brahmana tax collector. The priest named Balaramacharya also chastised Gopal Chakravarti. "You're a foolish logician," he said. "What do you know about the devotional service of the Lord? You've insulted Haridas Thakur. Thus there will be a dangerous position for you. You should not expect anything auspicious." Then Haridas Thakur got up to leave, and the Majumdars, the masters of Gopal Chakravarti, immediately kicked him out and dismissed him from their service. With all the members of the assembly, the two Majumdars fell at the lotus feet of Haridas Thakur. Haridas Thakur was smiling, however, and he spoke in a sweet voice. "None of you are at fault," he said. "Even this ignorant so-called Brahmana is not at fault, for he's accustomed to dry speculation and logic. One cannot understand the glories of the holy name simply by logic and argument. Therefore, this man cannot possibly understand the glories of the holy name. All of you may now go to your homes. May Lord Krishna bestow his blessings upon you all. Do not be sorry because of my being insulted." Then Hiranyadas Majumdar returned to his home and ordered that Gopal Chakravarti not be admitted therein. Within 3 days, that Brahmana was attacked by leprosy, and as a result, his highly raised nose melted away and fell off. The Brahmin's toes and fingers were beautiful like golden-colored champaka buds, but because of leprosy, they all withered and gradually melted away. Seeing the condition of Gopal Chakravarti, everyone was astonished. Everyone praised the influence of Haridas Thakur and offered him obeisances. Although Haridas Thakur, as a Vaishnava, did not take seriously the Brahmana's offense, the Supreme Personality of Godhead could not tolerate it, and thus he made the Brahmana suffer the consequences. That's fine for now, but the offense was to threaten Haridas Thakur with physical violence. So we shouldn't offend the devotees. But what led to that offense was a mixture of personal pride and an impersonalist philosophy. He got puffed up about his impersonalist philosophy. And so he threatened to harm the Vaishnava, Haridas Thakur. And it's interesting to note that after this, Haridas Thakur felt very bad and for the plight of Gopal Chakravarti. And so what did he do? He wanted to continue chanting the holy names. So he went to the home of Advaitacharya, who was a contemporary of his. They were both elder Vaishnavas. And he stayed for some time with Advaitacharya and heard about Krishna in Bhagavatam, different philosophical points, and he took prasad at the home of the Advaitacharya every day. This is what a devotee does when they're feeling bad. They take shelter of some other devotee. And one final little quick pastime about this issue of the incomplete nature of Brahman realization is takes place in the life of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Someone had given Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur some mangoes as an offering, but because once when he was a 3-year-old boy, he took a mango which was not yet offered to Krishna, his father Bhaktivinoda Thakur mildly kind of rebuked him, saying that you cannot take this mango, it has not yet been offered to Krishna. As a 3-year-old boy at that moment, he said, "I will never eat a mango again." And he never did. He kept that vow his entire life. So later, as an acharya, with thousands of followers, someone came and gave him a box of mangoes, not knowing that he doesn't take them. So he didn't take them, and none of his followers were also taking them. He distributed them, but none of them also would take it because their spiritual master wasn't taking. So all the mangoes began to rot. Now they were on a train going from Calcutta to Jagannath Puri. And it's very hot in those trains, so the mangoes started to really rot, you know. And on that train, however, there was an impersonalist philosopher who saw Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, knowing he's a Vaishnava, and started to speak his impersonalist oneness, everything is one philosophy. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave one of these rotten mangoes to one of his disciples and said to give it to the gave them some mangoes, rotten mangoes, and said, "Give it to this all is one philosopher. See if he'll take it." And the impersonalist philosopher was kind of in a bind because he was saying everything is one. So why make a distinction between one mango and another mango? One's rotten and one's fresh. So he was stubborn. He did it. He ate one mango. Gross. Okay. He ate two. He ate three. He ate four mangoes. Four rotten mangoes. And okay. He went and fell at Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's feet and asked for forgiveness for speaking this nonsense philosophy. Okay. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I'm sorry to go over time today.